Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
As you can imagine, with a name like mine, there are all sorts of stories that tie in with our family drink. One of my favorite stories is actually purely fictional. You may have heard this story going around the web at St. Patrick's Day, but it's an old one, of a brewing convention somewhere in the world. And at the end of the day's business, the heads of the world's breweries got together for a drink after the discussions. And the waiter came in, and one by one, they all ordered their family drink. And Augie Bush ordered a Bud, and Pete Coors, who's a great friend of mine, ordered his dreadful signature drink, Coors Light. Went round and finally came to the chairman of Guinness, who ordered a Coke. And the others looked at him in surprise and said, "Well, why aren't you drinking your family beer?" He said, "Well, you men aren't drinking real beer, so I thought I wouldn't either." That's our family. You only live once, if then. Many years ago, I was at a conference near Oxford, and at the end of the conference, people were sharing with each other, and a very wealthy American shared like this. He said, "As you know, I've made a lot of money in life." And he had. He said, "To be really honest, my motivation for making money was to hire people to do what I don't like doing." People thought he was building up to a joke. But he almost choked up and a tear rolled down his tanned cheek. And he said, "The only trouble with that is I've never been able to hire someone who could discover my sense of purpose and fulfillment in life." In many ways today, America, certainly in the business and the political world, is a buzz with talk of purpose, of mission statements, of making a difference in the world, of leaving a legacy or leaving the world a better place, moving from success to significance, as one writer put it. When Rick Warren, who's a friend of mine, wrote his best-selling book, A Purpose-Driven Life, which sold more than 30 million, what was stunning was the titans of leadership who got in touch with him. Many of the richest men in the world who you think had everything and yet talked very candidly to him about the loss of deep purpose and fulfillment in their life. That's what I want to talk about tonight. Identity and purpose. In one way, those are obvious things. And yet they're not so obvious. If you were to say to me, or I were to say to you, "Who are you? Put it in a sentence." I would be insulted, you'd be insulted. Something about who we are can be expressed, but it's actually difficult to express, not because it's vague, but because it's so precious to us, it's at the level partly of mystery. Having said that, when people asked, who are they and how do they see themselves as an individual, they usually answer somewhere along the lines of to be myself or to be like no one else is or openly to reject what other people think I should be and to be myself and so on. And you can each see what it is that you think you are. Equally, our understanding of purpose is pretty obvious if you think about it. Dostoevsky says, "The secret of man's being is not only to live, but to live for something definite." Søren Kierkegaard says, "The thing is to find the idea for which you can live and die. The great Jewish philosopher Abraham Heschel put it like this: I want to know the question that seems to encompass everything I face. What am I here for? Identity and purpose. Now, those are incredibly important and basic questions for all of us in life. But, of course, one supplementary question is why those questions have to be asked so often today, and what is it about our society that has thrown it up in the way we ask it today? The logic of last night and tonight should be obvious. The examined life, which I was talking about last life, can be left as something rather theoretical, matter of meaning, maybe detached, something we can consider from an armchair. But if we're talking about our own identities, and we're talking about purpose through the whole of our lives, we're talking about something very personal, and very practical, and very existential. And of course it raises the question, think of that little saying, you only live once, if then. Are we in fact all making the most of life? Or are we missing out on things that are falling short? If you think of a purpose in life, it would be obvious if you're looking at a sports coach, say the NFL, to go into a game without a game plan would be absurd. For an entrepreneur to build a business without a business plan would be absurd. For a general to go to war without a strategic plan would be absurd. For a political candidate to declare his candidacy with no election strategy would be absurd. But the funny thing is that something that's far, far more important than sports or business or politics or whatever, the whole of our lives, many people have no sense of purpose or any ultimate plan for what it means to have purpose and to achieve some fulfillment in life. And not surprisingly, so many people later realize they've missed out. I remember an evening, a fascinating dinner in Silicon Valley with some of the kings of the valley who'd made huge mega fortunes. And yet two words that came up 6 or 7 times in discussions over dinner that night was, there must be something more. Or as one businessman put it, I've climbed the ladders of success and then found the ladder was up against the wrong wall. Not surprisingly, as Thoreau put it, many people are in fact living lives of quiet desperation. Or as Walker Percy puts it, you can get all A's and still flunk life. Now, what is it to discover identity? What is it to discover a purpose that fulfills our wildest dreams and aspirations? Let me explore it tonight in 3 ways. First, by pointing out the different ways in which society shapes us. We're in an extraordinary moment in Western civilization, where we've shifted from many of the traditional ways of seeing and understanding things to all sorts of modern fluid ways of seeing and understanding things. And these deep, huge transformations in our society shift the way that people understand their identity and purpose. Very few of us today have truly been brought up in a traditional way, although some of us have more or less of it in our past. But if you go back to pre-modern or traditional society, identity and purpose would have been rooted in community. And community would have been broadly face-to-face and often deeply intimate and therefore, maybe without using the word, strongly accountable. So that people were visible to each other. And one of the key notions in traditional society is the idea of a close proximity. To us, it's almost unimaginable that a capital punishment in the ancient times was exile, to be removed from that place which was your home, was tantamount to a death sentence. Socrates offered exile, or hemlock, chose hemlock. And you can see that in those days where proximity and closeness and the face-to-face quality of relationships were strong, you had what we now call thick community. And in such a world, people's identity was almost taken for granted. People's purpose was almost taken for granted. The expectations that surrounded them, the roles they were called to play, were just almost there in their mother's milk, washed down in the rain, or however they liked to use it. The institutional world in which they lived was solid, or as I said today, we'd call it a thick community. But of course, except for the few in the modern world, that's gone. Changed by the transport revolution, changed, of course, more recently by the communications revolution. So all our worlds are now thin communities, if they're communities at all. Far, far bigger. Far more stretched out. Far more mobile. Even in the early days of the 19th century in London, it was said in that day of fast revolving door relationships that the average Londoner, and this is the 19th century, would have known more people in 1 week than a medieval man would have met in a lifetime. And the world started changing dramatically. And obviously that was true, too, of identity. Because instead of the thick communities where identity and purpose was taken for granted and given, we are now in thin communities where we have to pursue identity much more self-consciously and in different ways. You can see in our own world, there are two broad responses to this. One is the more individualistic response, that both purpose and identity are a matter of do-it-yourself. In other words, it's up to us to construct it. We've shifted from community to associations, from a massive stability to a high degree of mobility, from a face-to-face accountability to often relationships that are almost anonymous. One great social scientist puts it, we've moved from solid institutions with a deep bonding in all our relationships to liquid institutions where the ties that bind us have been eroded or severed or have just melted. Now, there are various ways of describing identity in our modern world. One early thinker described it as the shift from traditional furniture. Think of a Georgian chair. Beautiful, yes, but solid, fixed, and final in its present condition, in its original condition. So a Chippendale chair is a Chippendale chair is a Chippendale chair. But, the same man said, modern identity is not like that. It's much more like modular furniture. You can change it. You can rearrange it. You can dispose it. You can do it any way you like because we're in modular world and we are modular people living here, living there, behaving this way, behaving that way, and so on. Someone else said that traditional identity was like a jigsaw puzzle. You have the box, and within the box are all the various pieces that make up the picture, and the picture's on the outside of the box. So the traditional jigsaw puzzle is a goal-oriented game. Everything's there. You've just got to get there as fast as you can. But what's there and the goal is eventually clear. Whereas today, as they say, we're in much more of a bric-a-brac, a collage world, where we're putting together our own lifestyles and our own identity and our own community, constantly changing them to suit where we are at the present moment. So modern identity is protean rather than fixed. We have identikit personalities. We are composite people, as it were. We're patchwork personalities. We have a portfolio of careers and a portfolio of faces we can put on in this world. So in the traditional world, the problem was conformity and often confinement. We tend to be romantic about the small town or the old village, but in fact, for many people, it was very claustrophobic and confining, and there was no way for many of them of escaping it. The old problem was conformity. The new problem, as they say, is inadequacy. in a world of endless possibilities that you can be, do, say, buy, whatever, the question is, how can I be adequate to do the job I dream of or other people expecting me or do what's cool or hip or whatever? And you can see the new ideal like things like cool. Or as it's put, no ties, no tears. Everything in terms of bonds is melted down. So hookups are possible, makeovers are possible, impression management is the name of the game. And at the beginning of the 20th century, this was brilliantly described by Robert Musil in his great novel, The Man Without Qualities. A man for whom there was no there, in terms of constancy in his character. There was no core character. There were no constant convictions. He was whoever you wanted him to be, and whoever that face would benefit him in the particular moment. And you can see that today. No ties, no tears. No truths, and so no treasons. And many people are on the flight from a deep, real intimacy in our world in the day of do-it-yourself or self-constructed identity. The second modern way, of course, is much more collective. People who gain their identity from movements. And so we're in the day of identity movements and identity politics. And people associating with these things and gaining a surrogate sense of community by that. But in a sense, all of them bereaved from their traditional communities. Many of the studies of American immigration, for example, would argue that when people came, say, from Europe, or whatever the old world was of theirs, moved from Europe to the US, there was a triple transformation in being Americanized. First, they shifted from group affiliations, which were strong in Europe, to being individuals as Americans. Secondly, they shifted from a strong emphasis on blood and kinship to an emphasis on beliefs and the American creed. And they shifted from a strong sense in Europe of the past and tradition to a clear sense in America of the future and possibility. Now that, of course, was then. And more recently, you can think how much group identification and roots and various things like that have come in, as many people realize that the arduous task of building their own identities all by themselves is too much. And so they would prefer, maybe subconsciously, to join the group that gives them the identity, the badge, the allegiance, the sense of belonging for which they long. Now, we need to all examine ourselves. Do we grow up in a very traditional society? Are we more those who've been taught various ways to do it all ourselves? Or are we those who are identifying with groups? You can clearly see how the shape of the society in which we live and grow up begins to shape the way we see identity and purpose. That's one way of exploring it. The second way of exploring it, equally importantly, would be to see how different faiths, philosophies, worldviews, ways of life also give entirely different views of identity and purpose. I often say that if you look at the consumer market of faiths and ideologies today, it looks bewildering in its overload. Who on earth can look through 1,001 faiths, philosophies, ideologies to choose what is true or useful to them? And yet, the number is actually boiled down considerably, first by the fact that seekers have their own questions, their own urgent pressing issues, so they're not looking at every answer in the market, they're looking for certain answers, not others. But the main reason the issue is narrowed down is because while there may be 1,001 different answers on offer in the market, there are, for all practical purposes, I was saying in the question time last night, three big families of faiths. I use the word family of faiths, which is the philosopher's word, for different faiths that have a common family resemblance, because they all go back to the same ultimate source of reality. And when you see it that way, for all practical purposes in our modern world, there are three big families of faiths. The Eastern, which of course includes Hinduism, the oldest, Buddhism, the Reform movement, and modern varieties of the New Age movement. And all together, they go back to what is understood as an impersonal ground of being. The second great family of faiths in our world is the secularist. And again, a variety. Atheists, agnostics, materialists, naturalists, various ways of seeing it and saying it, but almost all of them together go back to a sense that the universe comes not from an impersonal ground of being, but from ultimate chance. And the third great family of faiths are the Abrahamic faiths, which in the West are the two great biblical faiths, Judaism and the Christian faith, whose view of ultimate reality is that everything comes from a personal infinite God or an infinite personal God, and everything flows from that understanding. Now you could see the consequences of this in all sorts of areas, from the notion of the origins of the universe right through to the prospects of the universe, questions like evil, questions like humanity and human rights, and so on. But let me just very briefly take the example of identity and purpose. Take the East. Buddhism, as you know, has at its heart the notion that what drives the world is desire. Desire leads to craving, craving to attachment, and through desire and craving and attachment, we are bound to the wheel, and here we are in this world of samsara or suffering, and we're caught in this veil of illusion. So what is freedom for Buddha? You notice when Siddhartha Gautama was liberated under the Bodh Gaya tree, he didn't say, "I am liberated." He said, "It is liberated." And he had achieved what Buddhists call, and he called, the not-self. He hadn't become a full individual. Through the process of right mindfulness, he'd been liberated from individuality. You can see this affected everything. His own son, he called Rahula, which in Sanskrit means fetter or ball and chain. Because having achieved the liberation of the not-self, even his family relationships were a problem, a ball and chain in terms of his right mindfulness. He was then called by his followers the Tathagata, which means the one who has gone. As you know, nirvana is not like a Christian view or a Jewish view of heaven. It literally means the great deathless lake of extinction. And what's extinguished is our individuality. Buddha Gosa, one of his great followers, said, "I am nowhere a somewhatness for anyone." D.T. Suzuki, the great Zen master who was very popular in the 60s when I was a student, he used to say clearly, the goal of Zen is not incarnation, that's Christian. The goal of Zen is excarnation. And you can see clearly, as one philosopher puts it, the Buddhism is the most gigantic no to human aspirations ever leveled in history. In other words, if you ask the question, how can I become free as an individual? Wrong question. The answer in much of the East is forget it and forget yourself. Because freedom in much of the East is not freedom to be an individual, it's freedom from individuality. Well, take the answer of the second great family of faiths, the secularist. When I was a student your age, I remember going to seminars with Bertrand Russell, then late 80s, early 90s. Craggy, lined, aquiline face, immense courage, but a bleakly pessimistic view of the world. And he used to share with us his book, A Free Man's Worship, or his essay, A Free Man's Worship, which he wrote in Florence, in the beauty of Florence, in 1902. And if you've read his great essay, A Free Man's Worship, here he is as an atheist giving his manifesto of life. He says, we human beings are the product of a chance collocation of atoms. So here we are in a world which has no meaning. So it's not that meaning is to be discovered out there in the world. If we want meaning, we are the source of our own meaning. Now we have to found that meaning, he said, on what he calls in the essay, the firm foundations of unyielding despair. And we're moving towards a world which will extinguish itself, not in the Buddhist sense, but in an ultimate catastrophe. So meaning, Russell used to say, and he says in the essay, we are each like Atlas. We are like the Greek giant who creates and carries the world of his own meaning on his own shoulders, and it's all up to us. So you can read great atheists, say, Swinburne, glory to man in the highest, for man is the master of things. And it's proud, and it's inspiring, but is it possible? Julian Huxley, also powerful when I was a student, used to say, today in the 20th century, this is the 60s, today in the 20th century, the evolutionary process is at last becoming conscious of itself. And it's up to us men, before the age of inclusive language, to make ourselves as human beings. John Kennedy himself, President Kennedy, all man's problems were created by man and can be solved by man. If you've read Friedrich Nietzsche, whom for a while I used to read once a year just as a sort of intellectual test and tryout of my own faith and thinking through the issues of life, Nietzsche says, each of us must so live, and of course he's the grand atheist, each of us must so live to be able to say at the end of it, thus I willed it. Our willpower shapes life. All ourselves. Ayn Rand, who is his great disciple, whose books have been read by so many and was the hero of people like Alan Greenspan, she says, following Nietzsche, you must so live to be able to say, and I mean it. Each of us, with our own will, stamps it on life. Now, the free man's worship is actually beautiful and poignant in many parts. But if you read Russell's later works, certainly by the age when I knew him, he says his worldview was still an atheist one. But his call for the beauty and the altruism of that early worldview, he said he then later realized was a false gospel which could never be fulfilled. And if you read some of the 1960s atheists, like Sartre and so on, you have a very different position. Here's Sartre towards the end of his life. Atheism is a cruel long-term business. I believe I've gone through it to the very end. There's no question that all the great atheists I've known are people of immense courage. But with their worldview and their view of the universe coming from chance, moving to extinction, each of us solely dependent on our own strength for everything we do, there's a bleakness if there's a courage. And very often it's the suburban, common or garden atheists who are cheerful, happy-go-lucky people. But the atheists who have the courage to look out on the long reaches of history and the far reaches of the cosmos are very rarely optimists. But the whole position there, identity, purpose, do it yourself. Frank Sinatra style. I do it my way. The third great family of faiths has a very different answer. The Jewish and Christian. And at this point, there's no daylight between them. And the answer, of course, begins with a personal infinite God and starts, but doesn't end, with creation. Because of creation, every one of us in the biblical worldview is seen as unique and precious because made in the image of God. Because of creation alone, you could say the biblical answer is, be who you are. Because we're all created unique. But that isn't the end of the answer. And while the Bible starts with the notion of creation, It continues with the notion of calling. And if creation means be who you are, God's call to us, the Creator, calling us out, knowing us, our gifts, our aspirations, our capacities, our potential, knows us better than we know ourselves, better than those nearest and dearest knows us. As our Creator, the personal God, calls us out, we can go higher, reach further, in touch with parts of ourselves that nothing else would reach. And so while creation is be who you are, calling is also become whom you can be. And there's a process of not just being, but of becoming and growing until we meet our Creator and the caller face to face. If you look over the history of the world, it is no surprise that that biblical, Jewish, Christian notion of calling, sometimes to a nation like the Jewish people, sometimes to individual as the followers of Jesus, that notion is actually the deepest sense of human purpose seen in history. Let me go on thirdly to describe some of the master themes that have grown out of this and challenge you to think. You can go the Eastern way, but that way does not lie the way of individual fulfillment or strong identity. You can go the secularist way, and certainly in your 20s, when you're young enough, wealthy enough, and all those good things, it's a very appealing way to go. But in the long run, there is nothing like the Jewish and Christian notion of our Creator calling us each personally. Let me mention three of the master themes you can see down. And when you explore these, you can see why this is a truth that has shaped history and genuinely changed cultures and can do so today. In other words, it's not just purely private and personal, but truly makes a difference in the whole of life. First, think of this one. Answer the call of God, your Creator, and you become an entrepreneur in life. We often think of the word entrepreneur as something for business people, and they are entrepreneurial. The idea of taking resources and maximizing and multiplying and so on. But actually, that notion is rooted in faith long before it came from modern capitalism. I don't know if you know the story of Yehudi Menuhin, the great Jewish maestro and violinist. He grew up in a Jewish family in San Francisco, very poor, but they loved music. And from the earliest days, they took him when he was 3 years old to the symphony. And he was fascinated as a three-year-old, not with the conductor waving his arms around, not with the trumpeter, but with the first violinist. And when he was nearly four, he asked his father if he could have a violin for his birthday. He had no idea. It cost rather a lot of money. And his family had no money. But to humor him, his father told a friend of theirs, little Yehudi wanted a violin. And the friend, to humor him, gave him a toy one, made of metal, with metal strings. And when Menuhin was 80, and then owned two Stradivariuses, and was one of the world's great violinists, he said at the age of four, when he was given this toy one of metal, he said, I knew it was grotesquely wrong. And not realizing the social awkwardness, he took the toy violin, smashed it in half in front of his father and his father's friend. Not exactly grateful. But looking back, he said, I knew even then, for me, to play was to be. Graham Greene says, there's always a moment in childhood when our gifts break through and beckon the future. Now, with a genius or a virtuoso in the violin or whatever, great gifts bubble through prominently very early. Most of us are not geniuses or virtuosi. But you can actually think back. There's a time, probably growing up, when there's something you did that was so you, there was so much part of your giftedness that you just felt incredible happiness doing it. you're actually very close to what the Reformation understanding of the words of Jesus is. Jesus tells the story of a king, a master, who gave out talents. 1, 2, 5, 10. And then in both the accounts of the story, goes on a journey and leaves his servants to get on with it in his absence. And in the story, there's no supervision. In the story, there is zero micromanagement. And at the end of the story, when the master, the king, comes back, they are praised and commended, or condemned and judged, by what they've done in his absence with the gifts that they were given. And as the Reformers point out, that's exactly the notion of calling. God has made each of us unique. You are a person like no other person. You have gifts like no other person in quite the blend and balance that you have. And the biblical, the Jewish and Christian notion of calling is that God is calling you to take those gifts and to maximize them, multiply them, trade on them. If you've got 10, turn in 10 more. In other words, you become, as you answer the call, an entrepreneur of life. Now, many people have misunderstood that in terms of the so-called acorn theory, that whatever you are as an acorn, you will grow into as an oak, and so on. No, no. The biblical understanding is much more open than that. There's no fate. There's no determinism. God, who calls us, brings into play the freedom of our capacity to respond, and we can truly become entrepreneurs of life. And if you want a life that is going to bring in your gifts, but do so for the glory of God and for the usefulness of our world, of all its immense suffering and need, answer the call. Calling is one of the great master themes there. Well, take a second, very different notion. Answer the call of God, your Creator, and your purpose in life becomes lifelong and worldwide. I'm sure many of you have seen the film Amazing Grace about William Wilberforce. My great-great-great-grandfather, who founded the Guinness Brewery, was a friend of his and supported him. But you know the story very roughly. Wilberforce, at the age of 26, experienced what he called his great change. A very carefree young man who hoarded and gambled and enjoyed all the life of the wealthy people of the late 18th century, came to faith in Christ and immediately experienced, as I said, his great change. Now, instinctively thought, if I'm now a follower of Jesus, I better do something spiritual and become a minister. Fortunately, a minister, John Newton, the author of Amazing Grace, said to him, for heaven's sake, don't. Stay where you are and ask God what he wants you to do where you are with your opportunities and your gifts. And for 2 years, he thought and prayed. And at the end of that, he wrote down what is reckoned to be the most audacious personal mission statement in all human history. He wrote down as a 28-year-old, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners or moral standards. And can you imagine writing that? The slave trade was the greatest evil of the day, and it was about as written into the British Empire as, say, the defense industry is in America today. To root it out, a colossal task, but at least you could do it through an act of Parliament, even if it took you 47 years. On the other hand, the reformation of moral standards, with the corruption, the decadence, the violence, and so on of England and France in the late 18th century, must have been overwhelming. But when he died, he achieved both and truly changed the face of much of the earth. And he is seen now by historians as the greatest social reformer in all history. Now, where did he get that odd idea that if he was a Christian now, he should be a minister? The idea actually goes back to some dreadful teaching in the 3rd century, not Jesus. When a bishop, called Eusebius, said that the Christian life is of two different types, the perfect and the permitted, the spiritual and the secular, the full-time and the part-time. And of course, the perfect, the spiritual, the full-time are the ministers, the priests, the monks, the nuns, and so on. And that two-tier universe runs through much of the history of the church, unfortunately. Martin Luther shattered it. One of his little writings, he said, the farmer in the fields, or the farmer's wife in the farmhouse, if they're doing what they're doing as part of their faith and their calling before God, that is just as high and holy as a preacher. Why? It is everyone, everywhere, in everything. And calling touches the whole of life. So you don't have to be spiritual and a minister, an evangelist, or a missionary. You can be a professor, a high school teacher, or an astronaut, or a politician, or a computer scientist, or a doctor, or whatever. Because it's everyone according to their gifts playing out in the whole of their lives, and this way you can see faith, calling, truly becomes salty, light-bearing, and dramatically changes culture. Calling is not some little thing you have on the side that once a day, once a week, you take off to church with you. It becomes this great master theme that calling touches every part of your life. Well, take another of the great master themes, and I'll make this the last. Answer the call of God, your great creator, and you will live all your life before one audience, the audience of one. David Riesman, the great social scientist who died last year, used to say we've moved from an inner-directed society to an other-directed society. In other words, in the days of the early Americans, say the Puritans, they used to have a strong notion, through the notion of calling, of what was right and true and just and so on before God, which was internal. And Riesman said, they were as if they'd swallowed gyroscopes. Their north, south, east, west, their bearings were internal because they had a powerful view of calling. Modern people, he said, are as if they swallowed not gyroscopes, but Gallup polls. Through a whole number of things in the 20th century, from television to statistics and opinion polls and other things, we are now other-directed. We're all always aware of what our peers are thinking, what the polls are saying, what the fashions are telling us what to do, what the latest, greatest thing is, what 51% now believe, etc., etc. And USA Today will tell us on the front page every day what someone's doing in that way, and so on. So Americans today are incredibly other-directed, often disastrously. You can see the difference in two great British politicians of the 20th century. Both friends, both great orators, and both great wartime leaders. One was David Lloyd George, leader in World War I, and the other was Winston Churchill, leader in World War II. Lloyd George is very modern. He was so other-directed, always aware of what the focus groups were saying, what the latest statistics were, so much so that one of his friends said, when Lloyd George was alone in the room, there was nobody there. He was only who he was in front of other people. Winston Churchill, on the other hand, was described as impervious to public opinion as a diver in a bell. Now, he spoke to people brilliantly, but he swayed them. They did not sway him. And that's exactly what the notion of calling once meant. The Puritans were as if they'd swallowed gyroscopes. You can see the early Puritans who shaped so much of the Puritan ethic and many other things that made America. What was success? They didn't care about success. It was purely external. Calling was living before one audience, the audience of one. What was fame? Fame didn't matter. That was purely external. Did it make a lot of difference? You made a lot of money or you hadn't made money? All those things they were relatively dead to, as the historians say. And one man put it like this. They were diligent in the world, the Protestant ethic, but they were dead to the world in which they were diligent. Because they were living with such a powerful sense of calling that they lived before what they called one audience, the audience of one. Now, that has huge ramifications that are very, very practical. Take one simple example, accountability. In a fallen world, as we live in, or put it in Kantian terms, a world where humanity is marked by its crooked timber, in a fallen world, morality, I'm not being cynical saying it like this, morality is often accountability through visibility. People do what's right, not because it's right, but because they're seen. They don't do what's wrong, not because it's wrong, but because they're seen. But what happens when nobody sees? And we've shifted from a thick community where you have accountability through visibility to a thin community where more and more through mobility, we're anonymous. And in today's world, more people are more anonymous in more situations than any humans in history. And that's why, take Wall Street and many other areas, people driving through every loophole they can see when no one sees. But for the Greeks, very importantly, like Plato, character was who you are when no one sees. Take the story of Gyges the shepherd. But for Jews and Christians, that has a twist. Character is who you are when no one sees but God. And always, wherever we are, whatever we're doing in this life, we're living before one audience, the audience of one. So, last night my challenge to you in this fast life in which we're living was to stop and think and ask if you're really living an examined life and you thought it through. But tonight I'm challenging you to wrestle with identity, purpose. Who are you? And what is it you're setting out in life to do? And to see the differences that the different faiths, philosophies, and worldviews really make. Be very, very aware of some of the lookalikes. And let me finish with a very inspiring quotation from Friedrich Nietzsche, which has taken many people, inspired by it, actually, down the wrong path. But what's interesting is where he got some of this from. Let me read this to you very carefully from Nietzsche. Talking about our individual lives, our individual purpose, Nietzsche says, "No one can construct for you the bridge upon which precisely you must cross the stream of life. No one but you yourself alone." And here's the sentences that have inspired many. "There exists in the world a single path along which no one can go except you. Whither does it lead? Do not ask. Go along it." Then he finishes. "Who was it who said," and then he quotes, "a man never rises higher than when he does not know whither his path can still lead him." Many people have read that and been profoundly inspired by it. It's beautiful. It is inspiring. But which of us is actually equal to that by ourselves? And the sorry fact was that Nietzsche most certainly wasn't. But what intrigued me when I read that the first time, because I actually knew who'd made the quotation that he was quoting. When Nietzsche said, "Who was it who said?" The answer, in fact, was Oliver Cromwell. And when Cromwell said that, he was speaking as a Reformed Puritan in the context of calling. And what Cromwell really meant was very similar but decisively different. What Cromwell meant was this: a man, we'd say today, no human, a man or a woman never rises higher than when he or she does not know whether their path can still lead them. But then the crucial words Cromwell adds, "so long as the one who calls them is God." And that changes everything. We can go out into the unknown. We can tackle the risky, the adventurous, the daunting with confidence, not in ourselves, but because the great Creator who called us He is known, and our unknown is known to him. Alexis de Tocqueville was exactly right when he said, in great ages of faith, the final aim of life is placed beyond life. And that's what calling does. And I'd say to you from the depths of my heart, calling, answering the call of our Creator, is the royal road to both identity and purpose in life. And you can look across the centuries and across the continents, and no one else and nothing else ever comes closer. Answer the call. Or as Jesus said to his early disciples before he said, follow me, he said, come and see. And that, of course, is the invitation that lies behind Veritas and the ongoing conversation. But time for our questions again tonight. Thank you.
All right, we have plenty of time for questions. As with last night, please come forward to the mics and ask your question. Ask you to be as concise as possible, and please limit your feedback to us, maybe one follow-up question, so we can get as many folks up to the mics as possible. And I'll start with one, again, of my own tonight. Last night, in talking about technology and fast life, you majored on finitude and kind of a delight in the limitation that we have as human beings. Tonight, your discussion of calling pushes more towards an expansive vision of what it means to be human. I'm wondering if you could connect those a little bit or talk about the ways in which they might be related.
You mean to those who are not? That's who are here tonight who weren't there last night?
No, just to talk about that. The blend of finitude is human, but expansive vision that calling can give you.
Mm-hmm. No, I was trying to argue last night that one of the effects of our incredible fast life is to leave us with myopia. We're so fixated on the future, and the future's coming so fast that we concentrate on the immediate moment where the future's right in front of us, but that concentration leads us all to be incredibly short-sighted, which is a chief mark of our Western society. But the notion of calling, as you say, Wes, is expansive. Because God has things in mind for us far greater than our little minds can imagine. Probably if we were told all that our lives would mean, both for better or worse, when we're 21, 22, 23, we'd be daunted by it. But God knows exactly, and so a life lived in calling just goes from strength to strength, and from one wider vision to another wider vision. Because that's what life is as you grow fulfilled, you know, in knowing God. Is that the sort of thing you mean? You know, so much of our fast life is closing us down. But calling is truly opening us up to a very expansive vision. Well, let's invite people down from the student groups. Yes, sir.
Well, thank you. I had a question regarding perhaps people trying to find a career or job maybe related to calling, meaning doing something that is meaningful and helping others. And just the challenge that of living in a capitalist society, sort of the wants of, you know, whether buying a big homes or things like that. Oftentimes, you know, money would give us significance as well as sort of security. I mean, that's what a lot of people mm-hmm. would think. And it may actually blind to the judgment day question, you know, what did you do to sort of, you know, better the world and the contribution that you have made? Mm-hmm. Do you sort of agree with that or disagree with that? Or is that sort of one of the major reasons why people don't find the right callings, is that there are so many distractions out there and maybe kind of related to the priorities and antidotes that you have mentioned yesterday too, but sort of money related to the calling?
Ideally, someone should consider their gifts and calling before their career,
sure.
before their job.
Sure.
And those who don't, and those who say, you know, here's a career path, my parents want me to do it, all my peers are doing this, this is the lucrative field in my day, you know, we're all into this area, we're all now MBAs, we're all whatever,
sure.
who just go along with the flow, they're often the people who get to the 40s and 50s and suffer a midlife crisis. And they say things like, I feel like a square peg in a round hole, or I can't see myself doing this forever, or this just isn't me. And they're people who've chosen a job or an occupation or a career without considering calling. A friend of mine was recently at Williams College up in Massachusetts, and he said it was fascinating. They were discussing the recession. Now, of course, these are relatively wealthy kids in a very liberal, prosperous college. But he was saying these students felt liberated by the recession because for the first time in their lives, they didn't have to go to Wall Street and become stockbrokers or whatever. Their parents realized that their family expectations were too confining. And some of them wanted to be artists and some all sorts of different things. And they viewed the recession, understandably, as a liberating thing because they were freed from expectations of others and freed to choose themselves. Now, I don't know if they, at that point, were able to consider gifts and calling. But ideally, we should think gifts, think calling, and then choose a job. Now, many people in history and in much of the world just have to do what their fathers, grandfathers, mothers, grandmothers did. They don't have choice. But part of our privilege in the West is that everyone virtually middle class and above can choose a job or a career which fits them. In other words, the old notion of do what you are, which is the reverse of you are what you do, and so on.
Thank you. So, from a Christian perspective, how can one reconcile the violation of human rights with with the benevolent, ever-present God, and why, if God is ever-present, doesn't he act in times of need?
Well, he does. But let me pick up the story at its toughest. If you go back to Epicurus, who, of course, thought and wrote long before Jesus, or you move down to philosophers in the 18th century, like David Hume, or you come right down to J.L. Mackey, people like that in Oxford in the 1950s, one of the greatest, toughest objections to the Christian faith in terms of evil is what's called the trilemma. We all know a dilemma is a problem with two horns, but a trilemma has three. And as Epicurus and all the later philosophers put it, how do people who trust in God say that evil is evil, and that God is all good, and that God is all powerful? Now, this is a huge topic in itself, so I'm putting it in very, very shorthand, forgive me. It's far too deep a topic to do that in. But my answer would be, the Bible recognizes each of those three things, but it gives each of them a slight twist and turns them into a reassurance rather than a dilemma. The obvious answer to the three is relax one of them. Evil is not that evil, but we know it is. Anyone who's really seen evil, like Auschwitz or whatever, you know, my parents knew Nanjing after the rape of Nanking. Even the Nazis were shocked by what happened at the rape of Nanking. One of the most profoundly horrifying, the awful things in the 20th century. No one who knows that could ever say evil is not evil. But is God not all good? Well, if you have a shadow of doubt over God's goodness, you can't trust him. Is God not all powerful? That's the answer of Rabbi Kushner. Evil is evil, God is good, but poor old Lord, not quite up to it. And that's a terrible view for faith. The Bible doesn't say that either. But the Bible takes each of those and gives them a slight twist. Let me just take the first one. Evil is evil, yes. The Bible's insistence, evil is evil, and it should have been otherwise. What do I mean? I remember extraordinary incidents when I was living with Francis Schaeffer, and we were in Switzerland, and we heard the story of a Christian leader who's American, whose son had been killed in a cycling accident in France. And as the story came down, this man came over from America and preached at his son's funeral with great hope and faith. Romans 8:28, all things work together for good. And people said to Schaeffer, isn't that impressive? And he just said quietly, I hope the man feels the same thing inside. 3 weeks later, we got a call. The man asked if he could come and see Schaeffer, this great Christian leader. Schaeffer said, of course. And I remember meeting him and showing him into Schaeffer's bedroom, which is also his study. And 10 minutes later, the rest of us left the chalet, wooden walls are thin, you can hear voices raised. The man was cursing God, blaspheming, and why did God do this and take it, and so on. And later, when we went back, I asked Schaefer, you know, what sort of line of response had he given? He said, I took him to John 11. John 11 is famous because you have, on the one hand, the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. The story of Jesus at the friend of his, at the tomb of his friend Lazarus, who dies prematurely. The more interesting thing is not Jesus wept. Three times, it says in the Greek, Jesus was furious. And you have the strongest Greek word for anger. Aeschylus uses the word of war horses that hear the trumpet sound, rear up on their legs, snort, and rage into battle. And it means to snort in spirit. That's what Jesus does face to face with death. In other words, as the Son of God, he didn't thank God for evil. He and his Father had made the world good. He came into a world which he sees as broken and ruined. And when he sees it summarized in the death of his friend, he is outraged. And that's the biblical view. It should have been otherwise. So what we're seeing now is not normal. It's abnormal. Evil is a party pooper, the great cosmic party pooper, ruining things. And God is furious too. Now, that's only the beginning. You could say the same thing about the goodness of God. And I would answer there, if we had more time, no other God has wounds. If you read Isaiah 53, which is the prediction of the coming servant, hideously insulted, wounded, tortured, all to save people and reestablish justice. And for followers of Jesus, for whom the great symbol of faith is a tortured criminal on the cross, when you look at the cross, you see the lengths to which God went in order to reach us. So God does something. And so on. You could go on down the line. Okay. In other words, the answer to the trilemma has an answer in Scripture. Now, I've put it far too briefly, but we can think it through in depth. And I would argue you come to the deepest answer to evil. Any of you read any of the Holocaust literature, which is profoundly sobering? But I have never read a worse book than The Rape of Nanking. It literally made me sick to my stomach. If you've read the Holocaust literature, you know one simple fact. Atheist intellectuals were the least prepared and the first and the most to commit suicide in the face of supreme evil. As Viktor Frankl says, those who say, after Auschwitz, there cannot be a God, were not people who were in Auschwitz. In Auschwitz, Frankl said, and he was a believer, more people discovered faith or deepened faith than lost it. It was the atheists who never had faith who took their lives, like Jean Emery or Bruno Bettelheim or Primo Levi and so on, which is a very sobering thing. People of faith survived. And I love the way Frankl finishes his book. This is Man's Search for Ultimate Meaning, not Search for Meaning. Frankl says, if you have a little faith, a little breeze can blow it out. That's inadequate faith. But he said, if you have true faith, a strong wind will only fan it into a furious blaze. And when I read that, it reminded me of my own mother. We lived in a famine where 5 million died around us in 3 months in China, including my two brothers. I nearly died. My mother nearly died. My mother was a surgeon. No food, no water, no medicine, nothing. She said it was in those nightmarish conditions that the reality of the presence of God and his comfort was unmistakably real. So never let people say, you know, a cheap throwing at us, the trilemma. The Christian, the biblical answer to evil, it has a profundity the like of which no other answer has.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
May I address the last person's question before I ask my question? Yeah.
Of course, yes.
Okay, so please. I guess what I'd like to say is that sometimes what we think we need is not what God's will is. Sometimes God may even want to test us. And just as an example, my mom's mom, one time they were living during a famine, just like you were talking about, and they were living in a famine, and one night they were just going to bed, and so my grandma prayed, and she said, you know, God, this is all the food I have, so we don't have any more food for tomorrow. and so don't let my kids die, you know, from the famine. And so the next morning, somebody from out in the country, because we were living in the city, but somebody from way out in the country somewhere comes to them and knocks on the door at like 5 a.m. in the morning. And so they open and they say, well, God told me, like in a dream, that God's people were needing some food. And so he brought them a lot of stuff that was enough to last them for another month mm-hmm. or so until they can start harvesting stuff. But and so God is not always good, but God is always holy. And that's the standard that God uses for everything that he does. Okay, and my question now, I've noticed that you avoided mentioning Islam. Where would you place in your classification?
No, I didn't. I said, I talked about the Abrahamic faiths, which would be Judaism, the Christian faith, and Islam. And then I quickly went on to say, in the West, and this is historically true, the two leading biblical faiths are Judaism and the Christian faith. But there's no question that Islam is part of the Abrahamic faiths or the peoples of the book. In other words, it also starts with a belief in a personal God, although I would say its beliefs are the most distant from much of the biblical view, but it's within the Abrahamic family of faiths, no question.
Okay.
Okay.
My favorite novel is F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, which emphasizes humanity's like forever chasing after the facades of life and ignoring reality. And in that same thread, like my theology is completely affected by Reinhold Niebuhr and his constant awareness of human sinfulness and human pride. My question to you is, where does calling and identity and purpose fit into this flawed identity of ourselves that forever chases after a facade that we both want and don't want, and also a forever self-centered conceitedness of and vengeful pride?
You can take any true truth, any biblical truth, and state it in its positive sense, but also warn against the negative potential for exploitation. And that would be true of calling. So cheap grace is a distortion of grace. Now, the same way, if you think of calling, part of the wonder of calling is that God knows each of us individually. So we can say to ourselves, this is amazing that God's grace calls me, and I'm different, or you're different, you're unique, you're precious, etc. And the next minute you'll hear a voice behind you whispering in your ear saying, boy, you really are special. You really are unique. And the flip side of calling, because of sin, is conceit. Now, there's a wonderful story of Winston Churchill and Sir Stafford Cripps. Sir Stafford Cripps was a Presbyterian who was evidently rather self-righteous and very full of himself. And Churchill couldn't stand him. He was the ultimate prig, but he had to have him in his cabinet in World War II. And one day, Sir Stafford Cripps left the cabinet room, and Churchill said to the others, there, but for the grace of God, goes God. In other words, you can see the danger of calling is we start to think, I'm called, and then we grow conceited. Now, let me be really blunt. That's the danger of American patriotism. Manifest destiny. The Puritans believed that every nation had a calling. That grew in the 19th century for various reasons with the expansion westward and so on into O'Sullivan's notion of the American calling, which is manifest destiny. America alone was unique. And that's a very, very dangerous example. So that's a nationalistic example of calling inflated into nationalistic conceit. But it's possible with all of us. You know, if you see me getting conceited because of a notion of calling, challenge me. And you should do the same with all your Christian friends, and I hope they do it with you. So every truth, sadly, has its flip side of the evil one's suggestions, which can distort it. Grace to cheap grace, calling to conceit, and so on.
Thank you.
Hello,
Hello, Professor. Thank you very much for coming to give us this amazing, inspiring lecture tonight and on Monday night.
Into you.
Oh.
Right into you.
Yeah. I'd like to take this opportunity to ask you a rather broad and simple question, which I hope would concern all of us.
My question is,
how are we as college students able to feel the calling and answer it in a pragmatic point of view? As you said, our God, the Christian God, is a personal God. So I wonder, if there is a sign in our life that we should watch for, personally, to get in a deeper relationship with our God. And also, I'd like to ask you if there are books that you would recommend so that we can study further in this aspect.
On calling?
Yes.
Far be it to recommend my own. But there aren't all of that. I wrote a book called The Call. But be more serious. You have this wonderful time here at UVA. And I would say those of you who've become or have come to UVA as followers of Jesus, or you've become followers of Jesus while you're here, really make sure before you leave this great place, you have a clear understanding who Jesus is and his Father is. In other words, you know whom you believe, what it is you believe, why you believe what you believe. But the thing that's often missing today is people really understanding how followers of Jesus are called to live. And a lot of people learn a whole lot of doctrine up there, whereas Jesus actually had very practical ways in which he called his followers, and some of them are very tough to do. He called his followers to forgive without limit. He called his followers to return good when evil is done to them. He called his followers to love even their enemies. And you can see, say, the Christian right does not do that. When it demonizes its enemies, it's behaving in a sub-Christian or an anti-Christian way. So it's often these very foundational things that are there in the Gospels that Jesus is calling his followers to do. Now, all of that, in other words, join a good group while you're here and explore these things so that you know the Lord better and you really know what it is to be his follower in a world which is very different from his way. And all of that you can do and really grow in before you leave UVA. Yuri.
Hi. Again, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. My first question is about atheism. You mentioned that it's more appealing to young people, meaning less appealing to older people. My question is, why do you think this is the case? Is it because the older people, as they go through their life, they collected more experience, more evidence for thinking there is something more? Or is it because self-defense against death is sort of waking up in them and they are just desperately looking for something more?
No, a great question. I think all of the above. But put it this way, when you're in your 20s, which is most of you in the room, you guys are immortal. You're still at that age where you feel immortal. You're young enough, you're fit enough, you're reasonably wealthy enough as young Americans. The world is your oyster, and so life is all a matter of possibilities. But, you know, as people say, when you've gone through the valley of the diapers, and you've got mortgage troubles, and then health problems, and you know the state of the world, you know, to do it all yourself, and to have the illusion that you can say, thus I willed it. I mean, I would wish a lot of things in life, but I can't in any way. I live in Washington. There's 100 things I would like to will in Washington. The president, with all his resources, he can't will them. And the older you get, the more realistic many of us get about what is really possible in life. And that's why many of the older atheists who are still thinking in a big way are not as cheerful. And I say you've got the suburban atheists who are, you know, happy-go-lucky and everything's easy and so on. But when you talk to the Bertrand Russells and the Sartres, I never talked to Sartre, but certainly to Bertrand Russell and some of the others, they are not great optimists because that demand is not easy. I don't think it's even possible.
I can have more questions.
Yuri, I'm sure you've got lots. Last night you asked six in one.
Yeah, I'll sit down as soon as somebody wants to ask something. Okay. My next question is about like freedom of choice. And like if we are suffering sometimes because of our mistakes, then wouldn't it be like better if we don't have any choices and if we get just the best possible? I know this like whole country is based on freedom and it's like big buzzword here, but like I would ask if the freedom of choice is actually worth the suffering itself. Like if we have no choice but the best possible future, then what's so good about having choices? And if this is the better option, then why we are going through this world full of options where we can go wrong?
And Yuri, I think back over the years in which I've been a person of faith, I've met atheists who refuse to have children because they're bringing little people into the world who've got minds of their own. But the fact is, if you think of something precious like love, love would mean nothing if we're robots and just conditioned to whatever the sensory pleasures is that we call erotic or whatever. Love, I love you to another human being, assumes a choice. And you can see many of the highest things in life do. And if we're just programmed, like you were talking last night about the transhuman future, the post-human future, the robotic artificial world of AI and so on, you'd have humans without freedom. But you'd also have humans without the depth of their capacity of creativity and love and things like this. So in the long run, you'd be creating something subhuman, not just post-human.
I think love is just a feeling, and whatever feeling we can experience,
right,
it can be generated by chemicals, and it can be artificial. I know it sounds really bad because love is so great, but it can be done, and it can be much stronger.
All right. History will be the bet between us which proves us. We're already moving into a world where the scientists are saying we're determined in this way, we're determined in that way, chemically or whatever it is, so we're not free. But then eventually that will touch things like the law system. You can't hold someone culpable, responsible, in a law court if they're not free and made a choice to do that which is wrong and now they're tried. They're not. So they'd have to be treated Soviet style. The problem isn't bad behavior that's wrong. They're sick, and so lock them up. Let the people in white coats look after them, and so on. And you can see lots of attempts to do this, and if that's the world you're choosing, I think most of us would choose to be free and responsible, knowing that part of that is we'll make mistakes, we are flawed, and there'll be disastrous consequences too. But freedom and things like love and responsibility are so precious, we'd prefer to keep them along with the potential flaws. And for myself, I would not like a world that's deterministic, where it's all run by your AI experts.
Okay, I'll respond to this on my website, and I would like to move forward with another question. If still
well, give someone else a chance to come up, but ask one more in case someone else wants to.
All right, we were talking about identity.
Closer to the mic.
We were talking about identity, so my question is, who are you?
I said at the beginning, when I talk on calling, people often say, all right, tell me your calling. And I refuse to answer it. And I always say that, like, if someone asks me, who are you, like you did just then, as I said earlier, if you asked me, who are you, and gave me a sentence line to write it in, it would be an insult. But that's not because my identity is vague. It's because it's so precious, it's in the area of mystery. And so is calling. And I could actually say things that are publicly understandable in terms of what my calling is. But I resist saying that because it's not as simple as that. So calling is, to me, everything I am before God lived out in life. And I know the things I'm good at and the things I'm not good at and so on. And so I'm very clear about what's my calling and what isn't. But I wouldn't just put them out there in a book or a radio interview or whatever, because I think that's insulting each other. You are a person. Dignity, mystery, preciousness, much of that couldn't be specified in 10 words, even could 10 Czech words, and so on. And so on. So we need to preserve the mystery. But I know who I am. And I know God knows who I am much better than I know who I am. There's a wonderful essay by George MacDonald, who's the fantasy writer, who is C.S. Lewis's mentor. And he picks up the little phrase, you probably haven't read this, Yuri, but in the book of Revelation, God says to a particular church there, whoever overcomes, who's faithful to him, I will give him a new name written on a white stone which no one knows. And George MacDonald says, God has called us. We've never seen the caller. All through our life, we're following a call. We've never seen the caller. But then when we meet him face to face at the end of our life, we will see the caller. He will give us our name because we will have become the name that he had in mind for us. In other words, the nature and the name will come together. Now, you get into extraordinary mysteries and things like that. But for me, very precious. That God knows me better than I know myself. And as I follow his call, I'm becoming who he has in mind for me all along. So I'm not going to put it in a sentence.
Thank you.
I do have a question. And
yes, ma'am.
I realize it doesn't have much to do with calling.
Sorry?
My question doesn't have much to do with calling. But
it's all right.
When we look at all that's going on in the world and wars and economic crises, I just tend to think there's a biblical basis for it all. And that somewhere in the Bible, God had predestined that these days would come.
Somewhere in the Bible, God what?
Had predestined that these days would come. And that there's biblical roots for it all. And I just wonder, where is it? Where is it? And why?
Francis Schaeffer used to say, always beware of the fallacy of this is that. In other words, the Bible says certain things will happen. But you can see over 2,000 years, people who said this in the Bible is that today or the other way around, they're usually wrong. Because when Jesus describes the future, he begins and ends by saying, nobody knows the time of the end. Only the Father, not even the Son. So when people today, Hal Lindsey's books or whatever, claim to say, what's happening in the Middle East, is this in Ezekiel or whatever, they're constantly proved wrong. And I think we should be very wary of that. And while you're right, God is sovereign, and he has plans for the world, the Bible also stresses strongly that we are significant and responsible, and we can make a difference. And you can see how many times in dire extremes people have stood in the gap and make a difference. So where exactly we are today, I mean, I often talk about where Western civilization is, where the American Republic is. That's not our topic these evenings. But I am not a pessimist. And let me just finish with one thing that I said this afternoon at Darden, because one of the questioners there was relatively gloomy in terms of where we are. If you look at America, America started as anti-imperial, throwing off the British Empire, Roosevelt throwing off the colonial empire, so on. America is partly anti-imperial, but partly an empire that doesn't dare name its name. And America's an empire by any other standard, de facto, informal, reluctant, whatever. For an empire, there's only one stage after dominance, which is decline. But the framers and the scriptures should lead us to the place we're not pessimists, because there is the possibility of renewal. So I was arguing, and I won't go into the whole argument, but the framers saw a parallel between the Jewish understanding of the possibility of a return. Things can be turned around when the people return to God. The Puritans understood that as revival, an awakening. The framers understood, put it in George Mason's language, you needed a frequent recurrence to fundamental first principles if you were to go forward powerfully. Or as Thomas Jefferson, your local hero, said, you have to have a revolution every 20 years. In other words, America's at a place today, and if you take all the issues, international standing, economic crisis, immigration, healthcare, social security, all of them are raising questions which go down to foundational principles in the Republic. And at the contemporary generation, or really since the 60s, you have abandoned your framers' ways. But there is the possibility of what Mason calls a frequent recurrence. And I pointed out the two of the most powerful movements in Western history, the Renaissance and the Reformation, were both a return to the past. They were not reactionary. In returning to the past, there was a huge progressive movement forward. And what America needs today is not an antiquarian return, but a powerful return to the first principles of the American experiment to renew much of the promise of America, which is in deep problems at the present moment. So I'm personally, and I'm an Englishman and an outsider, although an admirer of America, I am not a pessimist at all. But you've got to have leadership, you've got to have vision, you've got to have people who address the present crises. The Wall Street crisis is replete with lessons of what should have been done and wasn't, etc.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.